The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I have a prepared lecture here, but I'm really using it as a reminder of what I want to say, because so many things happen in the field we're talking about that What I said last month is almost old hat now, and there are new things that have happened that are worthwhile talking about. But let me start by saying that one of the things that has always impressed me about the great hymns of the Christian faith is one line in that old stalwart, How Firm a Foundation, where the hymn writer asks the question, what more can he say than to you he hath said? And in a sense, when I talk after these films, I wonder what more I can say that we haven't given you the beginnings of in these films. But there are a number of loose ends that I think you should be aware of, and there are the changing things on the current scene that I think you should know about. And for that reason, if what I have to say seems to be bumpy and jumpy, it's because I interrupt what I had once planned to be a straightforward lecture, because I think there are other things that you should know that are more current. Several years ago, at the University of Pennsylvania, where I have been privileged to teach since 1942, a student went into the gymnasium and set up on their ends 16,000 dominoes, and did this in such a way that when he knocked over the first, the second fell, and the second knocked over the third, and the third the fourth, and so on, until, in orderly fashion and without any break in continuity, all 16,000 dominoes fell. Now, you may not agree with me, but I consider that to be a colossal waste of time, but it did get for that young man a citation in the Guinness Book of World Records. But college students being what they are, the domino crown has left Pennsylvania and has gone elsewhere, where a student had the time, energy, and money to get together 23,000 dominoes. Now, the only reason that I mention that is that the subjects of the three films that have to do with the immoralities we're talking about, and you've seen two of those, are, to me, somewhat like falling dominoes. The first domino to fall was abortion on demand, and it fell with a loud thud. And everybody knows about abortion on demand because it is a public issue. You can't pick up the newspaper and read it without knowing something about this. And abortion has split our society as no other social issue has since the days of the practice of slavery, which took 100 years of bitterness and a civil war to overcome, if indeed we have overcome it at all. The second domino to fall was infanticide, and that fell very silently, because unless you hear someone like me who was willing to talk about the subject, or unless you know someone who works in the intensive care unit of a hospital for children or a newborn nursery, infanticide is practiced behind the shielding facade of a hospital. The third domino is euthanasia. It has been struck, and it is falling. Now, these three dominoes, abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, are, in a sense, things that might be used by the next generation, if we have one, to judge us in this generation. But meanwhile, they are certainly examples of the erosion of what an earlier generation called the sanctity of human life, an acknowledgement that man is unique because he has been created in the image of God. The three inhumanities of today's films are being practiced against a background of moral decay in America, in a hedonistic society where life other than one's own is lightly esteemed and readily destroyed. Now, I'm sure that some of you have already said that really is an exaggeration. But let me recount for you very briefly four stories that appeared in the headlines of our newspapers all about the same time just a few months ago. First, a Washington, D.C. grand jury refused to prosecute a woman who went into the hospital room of her father with a pair of scissors secreted on her person, cut his intravenous tubing, cut his respirator so that he died. She then wrote a 3-page confession, took it out to the authorities, but they refused to prosecute her because they said he was going to die anyway. The second story has to do with a thing that happened in Baltimore, where a nurse went into the intensive care unit where she worked and disconnected the respirator on 4 of her patients so that they died. The Baltimore City prosecutors never said why they refused to bring her to trial. Joseph Fletcher, the man who is responsible for situational ethics in this country, recently at a meeting of the Society of Genetics and the Law, said he favored the crossing of human beings with baboons in order that we might raise a generation of workers that could take care of our labor problems. The final story has to do with a little boy whose name is Philip Becker, who lives in California. Philip is a happy, joyous, loving child. He went to camp last summer. He goes to school every day. He enjoys the circus, and he's simply crazy about fire engines. The difference between Philip and most other little boys is that Philip has Down syndrome or mongolism, which means he is retarded. But as you probably know, in mongolism, the degree of retardation varies from patient to patient. And Philip happens to be one of those whose psychological tests indicate that he is a high-grade Down syndrome child and that he will probably be able to be essentially self-sustaining and work in a sheltered workshop in days to come. At the present time, he feeds, toilets, and dresses himself, and as a matter of fact, helps other children in the institution where he is incarcerated do those very things. Now, Philip has heart disease, which can be corrected by a surgical procedure now, but not by a surgical procedure later. And without this surgical procedure, he will die well before the age of 30. This is not just something he lives with. He has pain with it and goes into agonizing spells of shortness of breath and blueness, which are very uncomfortable for him to bear and for others to see. His family visits him in the institution where he lives on the average of twice a year. And when the proposal for operation was made, they declined. And eventually this became an issue before the courts. And when a pediatrician was asked to state his opinion, he put it in this crass way. "I therefore feel that the Beckers are completely justified in refusing to have risky cardiac surgery done on Philip with the goal of increasing his life expectancy, of a life that I consider devoid of those qualities which give it human potential." Said the father, "It is my primary responsibility. It would be better that he were dead than alive." You see, Philip's father is not concerned that the risk will lose Philip's life. He's concerned that the risk will increase Philip's life. Well, a lower court in California did decide it was the family's right to refuse surgery, but a group of about 75 people signed a petition to the Attorney General of California asking him to appeal the case. These were doctors, lawyers, teachers, friends of the Beckers who knew this boy, the parents of other children that were in the same institution with Philip, and they all knew him personally and they understood the specialness and the value of his life. The Attorney General's court did appeal, but lost that decision in May of 1979. Just in the past 2 weeks, the Supreme Court has refused to review the action of the Superior Court of California, so Philip Becker is now consigned to having the spells that he has and will die of his congenital heart disease long before what his ordinary life expectancy would be. Now, we could ask ourselves, whatever happened to our judiciary? Last year was the International Year of the Child. Why didn't some organization, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, which distributed hundreds of thousands of buttons saying, "Stand up for children," why didn't somebody stand up for Philip Becker? Because believe me, if the Philip Beckers of this world are having difficulty in their fight for life, what is going to happen to more seriously handicapped children and adults? In 1973, the Supreme Court, in making abortion on demand the law of this land, set the stage for infanticide and euthanasia. Or if you want to put it another way, you could say first the unborn were deprived of their right to life, which had been theirs for centuries, and then the newly born were classified as having no meaningful life or life not worth living. Let me ask you now how you feel about the sick and the aged, the infirm and the senile, compared to the way you felt, say, 5, 7, 10 years ago. When you talk about a better society, what do you really have in mind? And when you talk about an improved quality of life, what are your standards? Now, whatever your answers are to those questions, I am sure will be the thing that determines whether or not we have a society in which human life is respected or where it is uncharitably disdained. As I said in the question and answer period, of all the immoralities that we talk about in these films, abortion is the keystone. And because it is so pivotal, it may seem that we spend an inordinate amount of time discussing it, but this is essential for you to understand its central position. Never lose sight of the fact that one thing leads to the other, and were it not for the progression of events, we could never have gone from abortion to infanticide to euthanasia to who knows what in so short a period of time. James Hitchcock is the professor of history at the St. Louis University, and he takes the position that the abortion debate is not one between two opposing moralities. He claims that those who support abortion have no moral position at all. Here's how he says it. The struggle over the legal and moral status of abortion in America extends far beyond the lives of the millions of unborn, important though those lives are. It is finally a struggle over whether morality as such will endure and will be allowed to make its claims on the way that human beings live. There are several ironic medical developments that have taken place and some legal developments that I think you should know about. First, medically speaking, there is the test tube baby, which you mentioned this morning, and the salvage of premature infants. Just to get you straight on the background, there are those who have no regard for the product of conception because they say it is not a human being, it is not alive, does not have any meaningful personhood, and so on. But let's consider for a moment that test tube baby, the first one that we all learned about. The whole world watched this baby develop in a petri dish, nurtured in a biologically suitable medium, and then knew about the reimplantation of that fertilized egg into the prepared womb of the mother. If that was not alive, then you tell me what was. If that was not a developing baby, what else could it have been? And if it had no meaning, certainly nothing else in life does. In a sense, the test tube baby is one of the very best arguments that we have in the anti-abortion movement, primarily because of the unmistakable aliveness of that test tube baby and the fact that it certainly is not part of the mother's body. Approaching the life of the unborn from the other end, I can remember well when I was in medical school that pediatricians wondered, could they ever save the life of a 1,500-gram baby? Then when I was an intern, it was 1,200 grams. When I was a resident, it was 1,000 grams. And now we frequently operate on 700-gram babies, and not only do they survive their prematurity, but they survive the trauma of the surgical procedure that we put them through in order to correct some congenital defect which is incompatible with life. Recently, in the state of Virginia, three different hospitals with no special care, three babies were born, all weighing just about 1 pound, and all of them survived. Now, I think you can see what the future might hold. As pediatricians push back the time and the age and the weight at which they can save a baby, and as scientists work in this direction with the test tube baby, the day will come when these two forces meet. And then it will be possible to have a human being brought about through fertilization in a test tube and nurtured completely outside the womb, what we would call extracorporeal gestation. It is certainly a possibility. Since the writing of Whatever Happened to the Human Race and the preparation of these films, there have been two major legal affairs that I think are worth talking about. Two major laws passed by states in this country have been declared subsequently to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. A Pennsylvania law required that if a woman was to have an abortion, that the abortionist must determine if he thought the patient had any chance of viability, that is, being able to exist on its own outside the womb. If he thought this was the case, then he would have to choose that abortion technique most likely to produce a live baby. Now, that seemed very reasonable, you see, because when Justice Blackmun wrote the majority decision back in 1973 in Roe v. Wade, he said that when viability comes, never defined by the Supreme Court, then the state may but need not take appropriate measures to protect the life of that viable baby. So it was very logical that the state of Pennsylvania would take their cue from what the Supreme Court said and try to protect the life of the baby who was born alive by abortion. But Justice Blackmun, who wrote the majority opinion for that decision as well, said that Pennsylvania had taken the invitation of the Supreme Court too far. That was turned down in January of 1979. The second law was one passed by the legislature of Massachusetts, and they said that every child who is a minor legally and pregnant should be able to have an abortion only after her parents were notified and had some part in the decision-making process. But the court turned that down as being unconstitutional, and this is the way they expressed it. Every minor must have the opportunity, if she so desires, to go directly to a court without first consulting or notifying her parents. Now, just for a moment, forget anything about the morality or the ethics of abortion, but think about some of the other things that that might entail. Think of the devious thinking process of our Supreme Court justices who found something to grant them this right in the Constitution. Think of what this decision does concerning the rights of parents, or think of what it does for the relationship between parents and children, or you can think about it as one final blow at the family structure in America. One lone justice, Byron White, who showed his integrity in 1973 by dissenting from Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, said this: "The court now holds it unconstitutional for a state to require that in all cases parents receive notice that their daughter seeks an abortion, and if they object to the abortion, an opportunity to participate in a hearing that will determine whether it is in the best interest of the child to undergo the surgery." Now, that is a very important statement, because what you may not know are some of the sequelae of abortion. It is very difficult to get statistics on anything in this country having to do with abortion, because the ruling in Doe versus Bolton makes it possible for freestanding abortion clinics to keep the most minuscule records, and they're not governed by any bureaucratic method such as exists for the management of hospitals. The most recent statistics that I have seen, and these come out of Canada, indicate that the younger a woman is when she has an abortion, the more likely she is to be sterile when she tries to have a baby subsequently. And the statistics from Canada indicate that in the age of 14 to 17, just the age that this law was pertaining to, in that age group, girls who've had an abortion are sterile subsequently one-third of the time. So it is in the best interest of the child to have somebody who is concerned about the welfare of that child have a part in the decision-making process. So you could also say, whatever happened to the Supreme Court, as if we didn't already know. But we have come to the age of Kitty Libb. Gloria Steinem, who was one of the outspoken feminists who figured widely in the recognition of 1975 as the International Women's Year, and in last year as the International Year of the Child, said that she hoped by the year 2000 we would raise our children to believe in human potential and not God. So what do the Gloria Steinems of the world seek to liberate our children from? I can tell you from reading what they say that they do not like our traditional morality or our sense of values. They don't like the authority of parents, but under the guise of caring for the poor and abused, then the social planners believe children should be liberated from discrimination, from nationalism, from patriotism, from capitalism, and from militarism. In Sweden, it is now illegal to spank or to humiliate a child. What is legal is right, or that is the way a good bit of the world sees the situation. But the legality of abortion is not the same as the legality of, say, the practice of homosexuality or of gambling. No matter how strict or liberal your views might be in reference to these two matters, they lose their similarity with abortion because abortion has something to do with the rights of two individuals, the mother and the child. The real reasons for abortion in America are not medical. And let me say this as a physician. I really try to understand the abortion mentality that says abortion will take care of some of our social problems. And I truly try to understand as a physician the attitude that says a newborn child who has a defect has a life not worthy to be lived, and that this will take care of a social problem if we don't feed him. I really try to understand the social problem that people talk about in reference to the elderly and the economic and social burden that they become. But what I cannot understand is why my profession of medical people are willing to answer these social problems by becoming the social executioners of this society, because that's exactly what they have become. And I think what some of the physicians don't realize in this country is when you acquiesce to becoming the social executioner on a voluntary basis, the day may come when it is demanded that you be the social executioner on a mandatory basis. There are two very interesting laws that saw their juxtaposition in the state of Texas has a lot to do with what I'm saying. After the Supreme Court ruled that in certain circumstances the states could elect to have capital punishment, the state of Texas decided that they would reinstate capital punishment for certain capital crimes. And then they decided that all of the techniques that had been used heretofore for capital punishment were inhumane: hanging, electric chair, gas chamber, shooting. And they decided that the official mode of execution in the state of Texas would be a lethal injection through a vein. The state of Texas also has a law that says only a physician can give an injection of any kind through a vein. So by the juxtaposition of two laws, some doctor has already been named executioner for the state of Texas. I have to admit that the Medical Society of Texas has protested this on the same grounds that I'm talking about it here. You see, abortion is the taking of a human life. It's interesting to me that a biologist has absolutely no trouble in talking about life being a continuum from fertilization until death of the organism if he's talking about a sea anemone or an earthworm or a baboon or a dove. But when he's talking about a human being, the highest form of animal life, whether you come to that decision by evolutionary thinking or by creationism, there has to be some mythical time when that developing body is indwelt by a soul, and then man becomes important. But I have thought about this very carefully, and I say it with all sincerity. I am a soul. I inhabit a body, and I do have a spirit. And until somebody can prove to the contrary, I intend to assume that that soul, which I am, has existed from the moment of conception, and that the development of the fetus, which became me, was for the sole purpose of providing a body for that soul to become incarnate. Now, we have come a long, long way in our thinking about medical ethics. And you might think that that's a compliment, but it's not. When I was in medical school, nobody talked about medical ethics because everybody knew there was a right and a wrong. Today, in the 140 medical schools in America, there are medical ethics courses as part of the curriculum in well over half of them. But the people teaching these courses are not ethicists. They are people who have an idea. And that idea might be something today. It is different than it was 5 years ago, and it certainly is different than it will be 5 years from now. And one of the things that I think you have to be aware of is that since 1973, a whole new kind of breed of physician is being developed in this country, because they no longer are exposed to absolutes. They are exposed to situational ethics. When I talk to a medical student on rounds about the ethics of a problem in that bed over there, and then I drift from that into abortion, he looks at me as though I had grown two heads. How could anybody who claims to be a surgical professor and a scientist think that abortion wasn't the greatest thing that ever came to us as a means of solving a lot of social problems? It's very sad, but you have to feel sorry for him in a sense, because he doesn't recognize that just 10 years ago, perhaps the most loathsome word in the medical doctor's vocabulary was the term abortionist. But who is the most active abortionist that the medical student knows today? The professor of obstetrics in the medical school where he's being taught. And we've come that way in less than a decade. I mentioned the New England Journal of Medicine in the films. I mentioned it this morning. I've almost gotten to the point where I cringe when this comes across my desk on Monday morning, to find some new reason for amniocentesis, some new way of dealing with the defective child so that it doesn't hurt your conscience when you say we shouldn't feed him, some new way of being cost-effective for the elderly person who is dying and is in an intensive care unit. Why don't we pull the plug now and save the hospital and the state money and save his family all of that inconvenience and anxiety? I talked to you about how the New England Journal carried that article by John Fletcher in reference to the test tube, abortion for purposes of sex preference. And that, I think, is a very good indication of how rapidly things change. You remember in one of the films, Dr. Schaefer called attention to the fact that things change so rapidly now because of communication, that what happens here is understood over here almost immediately as compared to what it took, say, 10 years ago when communication was not that rapid. The example that I would give you is what I have already mentioned. I predicted, on the basis of everything I know, that we would have this kind of selective abortion for sex preference by 1985. I said that in 1976. But instead of taking about 9 years, we had it in three. And I think that we can count on things moving forward with tremendous speed unless there is some way to turn it all around. One of the things that I would like to add to your knowledge about amniocentesis is to say that there is now a new technique called fetoscopy. Instead of inserting just a needle into the amniotic sac in order to take a culture of the fluid, you now can put in a little larger needle called a trocar and follow that with a scope and just look through it, and you can see what the baby is doing. You can take a specimen from his umbilical cord. You can take a biopsy of his skin, and I'm sure the day will come when fetoscopy will be broadened to other avenues so that all kinds of defects at the present time not diagnosable will be able to be diagnosed. And there seems to be a developing sense in this country that parents have the right to a perfect child. And there is such a thing, legally, as the doctrine of wrongful life. It is possible for a baby who is born defective to sue his parents for that defective life if they could have prevented that life from occurring. And if that isn't a bunch of crazy nonsense, I don't know what is. And if an obstetrician fails to tell a woman that there is a method of prenatal diagnosis to pick up a certain kind of congenital defect, and her child is born with that defect, the Supreme Court of the state of New York says that that obstetrician is responsible for the life care of that child. Now, do you see what that will do? That puts the physician into practicing totally defensive medicine. He's going to get an amniocentesis on everybody because he cannot take the risk of what's going on. Now, I said this morning, I mentioned a conspiracy. You know, I'm not really a right-wing politician who sees a conspiracy around every bush in our government. But the reason I say that there is a conspiracy is that I don't see anything else happening in our government that is pro-life. I don't see our born-again president doing anything about abortion, infanticide, or euthanasia. I have never known that Jimmy Carter accepted the plea of any pro-life group to come and talk with him. But he has welcomed into the White House every gay liberation or gay pride movement in the country. He says, I am personally against abortion, but of course I wouldn't do anything to change the law of the land. You go back and read the things that he wrote as governor before he became president, his position is flat-footedly pro-abortion. The people he had around him in government when he was governor were pro-abortion and actively pro-abortion people who were concerned about population overgrowth. The people he has appointed as his personal advisors in almost every field, whether it is to do with human rights or not, are all people with a history of being anti-life and pro-abortion. HEW is that arm of our government which you would think, if they are the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, would be interested in your health, your education, your welfare, as well as mine. But they don't seem to be very much interested in those things. They don't educate us in the things we should know. They don't provide for our welfare where they should. And they certainly are not caring for health because they find that death is a very much easier way out. They advertise how much cheaper an abortion is than raising a child who is born to a woman who does not want it. The thing that struck me this past week as part of the whole conspiracy is that for the past 16 months, HEW has been working on a model adoption law for the 50 states. Now, this adoption law, you can just bet, will have to be adopted by the 50 states, or each of those states will not be eligible for whatever funds are available from the federal government to aid in their adoption process. Remember that it was the right of privacy that led the Supreme Court to come to its final decision of abortion on demand. Remember that and tell me where that fits into the following. I will not go into the 7 or 8 absolutely unbelievable provisions in this model law for adoption, but just let me tell you this one. When a woman gets pregnant, is unmarried and doesn't want to be, and doesn't want an abortion, she can, at the present time, put her child up for adoption, will know that it is in a loving home that desired that baby beyond anything else, and she can, in a sense, put that whole sordid business behind her, turn away, lead a new life, marry, raise a family, and go on and be the person she wanted to be. Under this new law, any adopted child may, at any time after the age 18, have access to all of his records, including the adoption papers, the name of his mother, the name of the father that got his mother pregnant, and there will be no warning of any kind given to the former mother who put that child up for adoption. In a sense, that and the other 7 parts of this bill make adoption of a child so punitive for the girl who is willing to put a child up for adoption that she has little recourse except to choose abortion. If that isn't conspiracy, then I don't know what is. If you don't like that term, you find some other one, and I'll be glad to use it. Let me just make a tangential comment while I'm talking about abortion and adoption. There are a tremendous number of frustrated childless couples in this country. And one of the things that has happened to them is that the pool of babies available for adoption has essentially evaporated. And what little is left will be done away now by this uniform adoption law from HEW. To show you exactly how tough the situation is, let me give you one anecdote. When I was in Minneapolis with the seminars last fall, I received a letter from an unknown couple in Pennsylvania who had read my name in the newspaper, and they said something like this: Dear Dr. Koop, if in your travels you come across an unwanted baby, think of us. Armless, faceless, it doesn't matter. We are having great difficulty in adopting. I was on the airplane going to Puerto Rico recently and got chatting with another passenger that turned out to be a social worker who had arranged an adoption for a family that was in my practice. And she confided in me that most of the adoptions that she has done in the past 2 years were defective children. And what I'd like to leave you with in reference to adoption is this thought, that there is practically no child that you could bring to me with a mental or a physical defect that I could not put into a loving Christian home within a month. That desperate are people to have babies. So if you have a woman, your acquaintance, who knows she is carrying a baby with a defect, and you can encourage her to carry that baby to term, you can guarantee to her that that baby will find a loving set of parents who will take it from her and raise that child as though it were their own. One of the things that has always interested me is that we have tended to become a sort of one-night-stand, throwaway society. You know, on any given day when I go to the operating room, I put on a scrub suit, paper, disposable cap, paper, disposable mask, rubber, disposable gloves. I drape the patient with disposable sheets. He has gotten his injection through a disposable needle and a disposable syringe. He's now hooked up to a disposable intravenous set, and he has disposable monitors on him for EKG. Everything that we use in the care of patients is disposable. And I have come to the conclusion that in this disposable society of ours, we have somehow or other been conned into believing that just because they are small, just because they have no voice, just because they can't mount a lobby in Washington to talk about their needs, that we have accepted the fact that the unborn baby is disposable. And you think about that sometime, because I think it has a lot to do with our thinking. I can tell you without any question that when something becomes disposable, it ceases to have value. Whitaker Chambers, you know, once said that Satan's greatest triumph was convincing us he did not exist. What I've been talking about today and what these three films talk about is sin. And sin has been buried in America. It has not been buried by any juggernaut of weaponry, and it has not been buried by any anti-religious effort. It has been buried only by human contempt. Our humanistic philosophers and many psychologists, whose contempt is perhaps the greatest, have replaced our concept of sin by an almost unbelievable drivel, which on the surface would seem to be so inane that most people could not swallow it, let alone stomach it. During my association with the pro-life movement, into which I found myself catapulted without really trying, I have come to work with a great many Roman Catholics. And let me say in passing that one of the great spin-offs to me of the pro-life movement has been to find so many solid Christians in the Roman Catholic communion. But the thing that I wanted to say about them is that they have carried on, really, for you and me as Protestants, a great fight for morality in this country. And one of the reasons that they have been able to do it is they recognize still that such a thing as sin exists. While we're talking about morality, I think that we have to say a little bit about the fact that abortion, infanticide are really terrible things, and they are social problems and moral problems and problems of Christian concern. But as Christians, we have to go back one step further and talk a little bit about something other than the unwanted pregnancy being the thing that is the culprit and the thing that we are fighting. We somehow have gotten into the attitude, I think fostered by Planned Parenthood, that pregnancy is our enemy. And do you realize that the National Center for Disease Control lists pregnancy in their catalog as a venereal disease? That's your government and mine. That is HEW. Christians believe that sex act outside of marriage is sinful, or they should. And abortion has just become the effort on the part of sinful men and women to enjoy the transgression of God's law by having an easy out. And all I'm trying to say is, if we're going to talk about the morality and immorality of abortion, we've got to go back a little bit further and talk about God's law and the fact that we do have the right to control our own bodies, but not after a woman is pregnant. That obligation comes sometime before that. And we have to take God seriously in this matter and not just say, well, that was something cultural for the day in which the Bible was written, or that doesn't pertain to me, or times have changed, or the temptation to become so great in my age that I can't really do it. God's moral order was not given with that in mind in any way. It was given to free us and to lead us into a life that has total and true freedom. And don't forget that God does not just punish people, he punishes nations. And I think that this nation is in for an overdose of punishment in days ahead, because remember what it says in Proverbs, and that is that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Or I could paraphrase it in the words of Winston Churchill, talking about the RAF, when he said that never have so many people owed so much to so few. I would say that in the United States, never have so many people sinned them against so much of God's grace as we have as a nation. Now, even Abraham Lincoln recognized the problems of secular humanism. Listen to what he said in 1863. "We've been recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity, but we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched us. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all of these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God who made us." Now, Abraham Lincoln said that in 63. The statement could have been made by any statesman today, but whatever, it leads me to believe that whatever happened to the human race began to happen an awful long time ago. I said I would say something more about the test tube baby, and let me just put it for you briefly this way. The controversy over the test tube baby is whether or not our society can justify the destroying of innocent human life at whatever stage of development for the purpose of gaining scientific information or facilitating medical developments that will benefit other than the baby we destroyed. There are several reasons why we should not get involved in test tube research. The first of these is to avoid bringing further trauma upon this nation that is already seriously divided over the matter of abortion and about when the killing of a human being at tax expense can occur. Secondly, we have to be aware in the test tube experiment of the absolute possibility that this matter of human genesis may produce a defective human being. Thirdly, we have to recognize that there is an immediate and not unintended assault against marriage and the family, and the immediate possibility of the exploitation of women as surrogate mothers with wombs for hire, and the immediate prospect of having right now the ability to design our descendants. That's the abuse of the genetic engineering I was talking about this morning. And then, in the remote future, but nevertheless a definite possibility, substituting laboratory generation from start to finish, so that I said earlier, test tube baby to full term without ever the use of a biological mother. I think those four reasons are ample not to get into the situation, and I would hope that you would recognize the things that could lead to this and the things that could happen because of that. We talked a little this morning about apathy in this country. I could say that I do tremble for the citizens of our country who are running headlong into destruction and give no heed to the logic of argument or to the future of their own progeny or to the demographic considerations of all of us. But I tremble more for the evangelical arm of the Protestant Church, because we are the ones today who have the oracles of God. We are the ones who have the obligation to be salt and light on this earth. And as a group, we have spurned that obligation and that privilege and are doing essentially nothing when you consider the size of our body and the paltriness of our effort. What does it take to awaken a nation to the dangers that face us? I don't really know. I certainly know that moral suasion does not work in the way that it used to work. Do not be misled, ladies and gentlemen, into the arguments about abortion that have to do with population. We are not in a population boom. We are having in this country a baby bust. And you know, populations used to be built this way. Young people at the bottom, broad base, growing to the top of the pyramid, and here's where the elderly were. The way we're built now is just the opposite way. And every young person today who will be a young adult in the early years of the next century is going to be an extraordinarily precious resource to this country. It may be the very capacity we have to defend ourselves in days ahead will depend upon that portion of our country that today are children. Certainly, much of the standard of living and our attitude toward life and adults will be based upon how this small band of people will behave in about 20 years. Do not believe the things you hear about the fact that you will someday be standing side to side like sardines and eating kelp because we have overgrown our resources. We have tremendous problems with food in this world, but it is not based upon ability to have food. It's based upon the pride and the sinfulness and the selfishness of men. Let me just give you a few facts from what I think are the best demographers in the world in Cambridge, England. At the present time, only one-third of the arable land on this continent, on this planet, is under cultivation. Half of the cultivated land is under irrigation. If every farmer farming today could be given the technology that is now available only to the top 10% of farmers, we would be able to produce, with the present supply, enough food to feed 12 times the population of this planet at our standard of diet, and 20 times the population of this planet at the Japanese standard of diet. The problems have to do with distribution, with love, with compassion. I work with a famine control organization in Chicago, and we ship hundreds of thousands of tons of wheat and rice and grain abroad every year. Let me tell you what happens to it. Just two statistics. Before it leaves this country, we've lost about 10% to theft, black markets, and diversion of traffic to other parts of the world. Speaking of India, when we get that food, the remaining 90% of it to India, before it is transferred from the dock to the railroad cars that get it to the village where there's a hungry stomach waiting for it, 40% of it is eaten by rats. Now, with those kinds of problems in the world, you can see that aborting a baby isn't going to change the situation for the starving person in India. We have a tremendous amount to do, but don't get the baby and the bathwater mixed up and throw one out with the other. I would like to say a few words about the problems that I think are existing in our world today and compare them with the things that were going on in the 1930s in Germany. After World War I, Germany was a depressed nation. They were not the world conquerors, the Kaiser had said. They were in hyperinflation. Their young men had been killed. And there were many German citizens who said, this is not the kind of a world in which to bring children. So although abortion was illegal, abortion began to be practiced widely. That led to the formation of the Euthanasia Society. And by the late 1920s and early 1930s, there was an active euthanasia society in Germany, started primarily by Bavarian psychiatrists. And they chose 176,000 aged, infirm, weak, insane, retarded adults and children. Some of those had nothing more seriously wrong with them than to be missing a leg which they had given to the fatherland in the First World War. Among children were those whose greatest crime was bedwetting, but they were not considered to be serviceable to the Reich. Now, for Bavarian psychiatrists to do this, believe me, is a corruption of medicine. It is a far call from the high calling of the art of healing. But if it had only been the corruption of medicine, it probably would have gotten very far. There had to be the concomitant corruption of the law. And so when the Euthanasia Society went to the High Court of Germany with this proposal, German law became corrupt. And you had the crossroads then in the 1930s in Germany of the corruption of medicine with the corruption of law. Although Hitler was the person that signed the order for those first 176,000 people to be killed, they had been selected while he was still a nothing in Austria. He gets the credit for it in the history books, but those people were chosen by the medical profession for extinction. Beyond that, the method of killing them was a gas chamber, and the method of disposing of their bodies was a crematorium. It was the Euthanasia Society and Bavarian psychiatrists who constructed the first gas chamber and the first crematorium. It was they who taught the SS officers how to build others at Auschwitz and Mauthausen and Belsen and Dachau. It was they who taught the SS officers how to do the job of killing and cremating. And I believe that what happened in Germany can happen in this country, because I am convinced that the attitude that existed in that medical profession in the 1930s has existed in this country before and during and after World War II. And I would submit to you that we today are where Germany was in the 1930s. We are at the crossroads of the corruption of medicine and the corruption of law. I've just called my own profession the social executioners of our time. And I think you understand that I think the Supreme Court is corrupt. Before you misunderstand me, let me make it clear that just like it was in Germany, a very few physicians brought this about. A very few jurists brought this about. It's the same thing in this country. A very few physicians are social executioners. A very few lawyers are the elite group that are changing our laws. But what about the other people? Why did the Holocaust come to Germany? Because there was no outcry from the other physicians who didn't like it, from the other jurists who didn't like it, from the church who didn't like it. And what's happening in this country today? No outcry from the doctors, no outcry from the lawyers, and no outcry from the Protestant church. And we should be ashamed of the fact that the only church outcry in this country that has come as a uniform body has been from the Roman Catholic Church. In closing, I've got to say this, and that is that as Christians, we must, by word of mouth, make it very clear what it means to be created in the image of God. Those of us who are truly Christians must give witness to the fact that Jesus, who existed in union with God the Father from before the foundation of the world, did indeed become flesh and dwelt among us, that his incarnation took place at conception, and that he came to minister to those people who today would be called the outcasts of society or those having lives not worthy to be lived. And finally, we must proclaim that life is so precious to God that he killed his own son in his plan of redemption in order that those of us who believe in him might have eternal life. Don't forget these issues, ladies and gentlemen. They are the most important social issues with which you will ever deal. Thank you very much.